is now open for the transaction of any business that may legally come before it.
Good morning. The first case for oral argument this morning is in the matter of the Eunice Thomas Reese Trust versus Core Trust Bank, and also involving the Enchanted World Doll Museum, who's the appellant. For the appellant, we have Mr. Dennis Paternos, an attorney from Mitchell, and for the appellee, we have Ms. Trudy Morgan, an attorney also from Mitchell. Mr. Paternos, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes. That is correct. I guess that this is a little bit unusual on its procedure. Generally, we have the appellant sitting on that side, so I got confused. But we'll let you go first. I guess you're both in agreement that that's the procedure, so that's the way we'll do it.
May it please the court, Mr. Paternos. The matter before the court is a motion over which this court has original jurisdiction. The trustee of the Reese Trust has filed a motion requesting the court to dismiss the appeal. The trustee asserts that there is failure to jurisdiction, and the trustee requests the dismissal of the appeal on two grounds. The first is that the Dow Museum failed to give notice of appeal to the Mitchell Area Charitable Foundation, and the second grounds is that the Dow Museum lacks standing to appeal. Briefly, this case is unique because it arises out of a Cypre action. Eunice Reese had established a trust which benefited the Enchanted World Dow Museum in Mitchell. When the Enchanted World Dow Museum became defunct and no longer existed as a charitable, it lost its 501c3 charitable purpose status, the trustee requested the court to take supervision of the trust and to modify the trust to declare a new beneficiary. The trustee served notice to the Mitchell Area Charitable Foundation and the Enchanted World Dow Museum. The Enchanted World Doll Museum filed an objection and requested the court to modify the trust to distribute the trust to the United Federation of Doll Clubs in Kansas City.
Why did the Mitchell charitable organization become involved? Had they sought to, or did the, who made the decision?
The trustee became came into possession of information that the intent of the settlor was to benefit the Mitchell area, and the trustee believed that the Mitchell Area Charitable Foundation had the ability to hold funds for a specific purpose in order to do that.
All right, thank you.
After the evidentiary hearing, the court entered an order declaring the Mitchell Area Charitable Foundation to be the beneficiary. Thereafter, Mr. Paternos filed a notice of appeal which he failed to serve on Mitchell Area Charitable Foundation. The trustee has filed this motion to dismiss. Addressing first the failure to give notice issue, the statute that requires notice of appeal is South Dakota Codified Law 1526A4. Subparens 3, and it requires notice of appeal to be served on each party other than the appellant. Because this is a Cypre action involving a charitable trust whose beneficiary failed, we believe we must look at both the general rules governing the procedural aspects of court supervision of trusts as well as the specific rules related to charitable trust in order to determine who a beneficiary is and thus who a party would be. In the statutes governing court supervision of trusts, a beneficiary is broadly defined as any person in any manner interested in the trust. Under South Dakota, that would be South Dakota Codified Law 21-22-1, which defines beneficiaries. Under the statute portion requiring notice, South Dakota Codified Law 21-22-18, it states that all such beneficiaries are required to be served notice in the underlying court supervision action. In addition, the provisions governing court supervision of the charitable trust indicate that the Attorney General must be served notice in such proceedings in order to represent all beneficiaries of the trust. That's under South Dakota Codified Law 55-9-5. As stated before, Mitchell-Ary Charitable Foundation was recognized as an interested party, provided notice of the underlying court supervision proceedings, and the president of Mitchell-Ary Charitable Foundation actually provided testimony in the proceedings below. The circuit court then entered the order declaring that the Mitchell-Ary Charitable Foundation was the substitute beneficiary of the trust. Upon entry of that order, Mitchell-Ary Charitable Foundation became a named beneficiary of the trust. South Dakota Codified Law 15-6-58 states that a judgment or order becomes effective when reduced to writing, signed by the court or judge, attested by the clerk, and filed in the court's clerk's office. The case law actually supports the position of the trustee under these circumstances. Under the Morrell case cited in the brief, the court stated that a right could arise from the judgment which did not exist before, a right which cannot be denied to a party to the judgment without notice, regardless of his failure to appear in the action or suit. This is exactly the case in the Cypre action, where a court enters an order modifying a trust, declaring a charitable beneficiary that was previously not named in the document. At that point, the right arises from that judgment, and the beneficiary becomes entitled to notice of the appeal in order to properly defend those rights. Dahl Museum asserts that because Mitchell-Ary Charitable Foundation was not a named beneficiary in the underlying action, they have no rights to the notice of the appeal. That position is contrary to the purpose of the statute and to the direct language of this particular case law. If that were the case, in Cypre actions, the new beneficiary would never be entitled to notice of appeal after being determined by the court. The Krupa case cited in the brief is helpful because it deals with the rights of trust beneficiaries to receive notice in the trial court action. In that case, the circuit court held that the pleadings had not provided the beneficiaries of the Atacupa Krupa Trust with sufficient notice that their rights could be modified. The court found that because those pleadings did not provide adequate notice, this caused a failure of jurisdiction and the beneficiaries were not afforded due process protection. This court affirmed that portion of the case. Because Mitchell-Ary Charitable Foundation did not receive notice of appeal, it was not afforded the due process protection to participate as an appellee in this matter. The other position of the trustee is that the Dahl Museum lacks standing to appeal. In South Dakota Codified Law 55-9-5, it states that the Attorney General shall represent the beneficiaries in all cases arising under this chapter, and it shall be his duty to enforce such trusts by proper proceedings in the court. What this says is that in a Cypre action, the Attorney General's office is a necessary party and must receive notice. The question is, does the Attorney General have the exclusive right to enforce and to defend the beneficiaries of the trust? Dahl Museum argues that Mitchell-Ary Charitable Foundation was not entitled to notice of appeal because the Attorney General was exclusively entitled to protect the rights of the beneficiaries and thus only be an only party entitled to notice of the appeal. However, that is essentially a knife which cuts both ways, because if the Attorney General is the exclusive party that is entitled to defend and protect the trust, then the Dahl Museum should not be entitled to even appeal and would lack standing to do so. Not all states are uniform on the issue of whether the Attorney General holds the exclusive power to enforce a charitable trust. However, the generally held rule is summarized in the Second Restatement of Trusts, Section 391, which provides that the Attorney General, the trustee, or a person who has a special interest in the enforcement of the trust may bring an action to enforce the trust. there are permissible parties entitled to participate in the underlying action, and then there are a narrower right of interested parties that are entitled to the protection or the enforcement in an appeal. The second restatement also states that an action cannot be initiated by persons who have no special interest or by the settlor, his heirs, personal representatives, or next of kin. It is true that the notice of pendency of a cypre action is given to the public, institutions, or persons who are interested in securing benefits from the trust, and sometimes heard by the court and sometimes permitted to intervene. This is often done broadly so that the court has the ability to determine which is the best charitable beneficiary to fulfill the intent of the trustor. However, it is a very different application to those who have the right to appeal. The general rule in Bogert, the Law of Trusts and Trustees, Section 441, is summarized, stating that the unsuccessful claimants of the fund should not be allowed to appeal from a decree exercising the cypre power. Thus, while it appears that under the general rule, a large group of interested parties are entitled to participate in the underlying action, it is a much narrower group who are entitled to appeal. An unsuccessful claimant cannot appeal, nor can the settlor, personal representative, heirs, or next of kin. None of these categories apply to the Dahl Museum in this particular case. To note quickly, it isn't clear whether the appealing party is the Mitchell Dahl Museum or the Kansas City Dahl Club. At some point after the court entered its order naming Mitchell Area Charitable Foundation as a beneficiary, Mr. Paternas filed an assignment indicating that Mitchell Dahl Museum assigned its interest to the Kansas City Dahl Club. However, no notice of that assignment was provided to any party. In any event, whether it's the Mitchell Dahl Museum or the Kansas City Dahl Club, neither has standing to appeal in this case.
Then there could never be an appeal, right?
The Attorney General's office could appeal if they felt that the public interest or the intent of the trustor had not been honored.
Were they notified in this case?
They were. I believe they submitted a letter indicating that they did not intend to participate in the appeal action. They were satisfied with the court's order.
All right. Thank you.
The Mitchell Dahl Museum did have an interest in the underlying action in the respect that if the trustee were incorrect and they were not defunct and had not and were continuing to operate, intended to continue to be a Dahl Museum and still be a charitable organization, they could have participated in the underlying action and said the court shouldn't change the beneficiary of the trust. So at that point, they certainly did have an interest in the underlying action. But because the Mitchell Dahl Museum acknowledged that it is defunct, that it has disbanded, that it is no longer a charity fulfilling its charitable purpose, it is no longer an interested party for the sake of the appeal, since it could never make a claim for benefits on its own behalf. The Kansas City Dahl Museum, at best, is an unsuccessful claimant, and certainly at that point is not entitled to enforce any kind of right in an appeal. The trustee therefore respectfully requests this court to dismiss the appeal of the Dahl Museum. And unless the court has questions, that would be the conclusion of my argument.
Questions? Thank you, Ms. Morgan.
Thank you.
Mr. Paternos, you have 20 minutes, sir.
It pleases the court, counsel. It seemed like only yesterday when I made my first appearance in front of this court. I had just returned from 3 years with the Judge Advocate General's Corps in Germany, where I learned some of the German language. To say I was nervous at the time would be a gross understatement. I was so nervous that I wrote the word, German word for slow, called Langsam, on the top of my notes, because I didn't want anybody to see that I was how scared I was, and that figured they wouldn't know what Langsam meant.
I would guess you're not the only one in that situation.
I recall it like yesterday. To go to this particular case, I'm going to try to follow what I tell my priest and minister, that I'm a firm believer in brevity is beauty. So I'm going to try to keep my marks very short. The determination of who has to be served on an appeal started with 1900 with Sutton versus Apex Mining, wherein the Supreme Court said the notice of appeal has to, party has to have had previously appeared in the action in the trial court. 8 years later in Crouch, the Supreme Court didn't really address that issue, but they held that the notice of appeal was not served on Sweeney, Martin, Leifert, Metropolitan Trust Company, and Bronte as defendants, and Reed as an intervener. Each were named as a defendant or an intervener on the record, and the failure to serve them, being party to the action, was fatal. In Morrell versus Stockman, later in 1957, the Supreme Court then ruled that those cases were holding that an adverse party had been served, were, became victim, and had no longer force and effect. However, the Supreme Court overlooked a very important fact in that case, that Mr. Levi, who actually appeared in the lower court, and he was named as a defendant, but he chose to let the judgment go without contesting it. He was not a fully unknown, unnamed, or non-participating party. They cited Lucy Ziegler and the Fergan cases, but what they've overlooked is that each one of those cases, every party that was not served was a party to the main action in the circuit court, and they participated in it. We suggest this Morrell case was wrong, as they forgot and neglected to review their own cases to determine that every party that did not receive notice was actually a named party, defendant, or intervener in the circuit court. The next point to consider is what's a party and what's an adverse party. We no longer have to require to serve an adverse party. So what's a party in action? We contend that Mitchell Area Chamber Foundation is neither an adverse party nor a party. Why not? Because they've never appeared, they've not been represented nor represented themselves, they have not intervened, they haven't appeared as an adverse party, had filed no notice of appearance, and has not appeared at amicus curiae, and they've never appeared as a party. They've more or less acted just like a beneficiary would. If we inherit this or get this, it's good, but they didn't take it upon themselves to move this case forward in any aspect.
You acknowledged, though, that they were entitled to notice at all stages of the underlying proceedings.
No, I don't.
Because they're defined as a beneficiary under the...
Pardon?
Because they're defined as a beneficiary, they're entitled to notice. Not, in the underlying, in the circuit court action, aren't they?
No, because they were an unknown at the circuit court action. It was only after the trial that the judge decided that the trust should deliver the funds to Mitchell Area Foundation. There's no way they could have been named then, because there's all kinds of charities that the funds could go to. They were not a party to the action in circuit court.
But were they a beneficiary within the meaning of the definition, the definitional statute?
I don't believe so. Every charity would be a beneficiary, and that's why we had the statute 5299, the Attorney General representing the unknown charitable beneficiaries.
But here the trial court listed them as a beneficiary. I mean, at the end, the court made a specific list of what specific findings saying that the names and residences and post office addresses of all the persons interested in the trust.
They're not in the trust. They were not named in the trust.
I know they weren't named, but the trial court made a finding that these persons were interested in, which included the Mitchell Area Charitable Foundation.
That was the trial court's finding. But there was no need on the part of anybody to serve the Mitchell Area Foundation, because it was the judge's decision that said the fund should go there. Otherwise, how would we have known who to serve? That's why we had the Attorney General of the state of South Dakota.
Were there other charities that the trial court considered placing money with besides the Mitchell area?
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay.
Is our position that since the foundation is not a party, either adverse or plain party, it is nothing more than a beneficiary of a windfall, it is not the holder of a vested interest. The case of Sioux Falls, before the adverse party was overruled, the case of Sioux Falls versus Noss had defined what an adverse party was and simply said that anybody would be affected by a reversal of change of the judgment. But Mitchell Area Charitable Foundation cannot be affected by this because they have no liability. In the Sioux Falls versus Nauset case, then Sioux Falls was a named party, and they weren't given notice of appeal, and they were affected because of their liability could be changed. Here, Mitchell Area Foundation has no liability. There's nothing they can lose. The most they could lose is a windfall for which, by the grace of God, they might get, but they have no vested interest in it. The judge's decision in the circuit court did not vest any property interest in the charitable foundation.
Mr. Paternos, once the judgment was signed and filed, doesn't that grant a vested interest?
I don't think so, not until the time for appeals has run, which it has not. We filed this appeal. The foundation had only a vested interest sometime in the future. The judge said in the future, Core Trust paid them funds to the Mitchell Area Foundation, but it did not immediately divest the trust from the funds, from the trust, and revest them in the Mitchell Area Foundation. Only after the time for appeal became so, at best, they had a vested interest and an expectancy. They had an expectancy, but not a vested interest. The only time the interest would become vested would be after the time for appeal expired. Then the judge could have said, okay, bank, pay the money over. Or the judge, in the alternative, could have immediately ordered the divestiture of the funds from the trust and revested the assets in the Mitchell area, which he didn't do. So this was a contingency in the future that the judge ruled for. Now, they referred to the Kropa case. The court in that, Judge Miller declined to find jurisdiction because all the heirs and beneficiaries of the trust were not named. When Otto Kropa, the grandfather, died, his son Edwin and the grandchildren, at that split second of death, had a vested and permanent interest in those trust funds. All the nephews and nieces were not served, therefore the court did not get jurisdiction. They had that interest vested the minute the gentleman died. And they were not served, so the court could not have jurisdiction. As distinguished from this case, where the foundation has no present interest in the trust, it's only a future interest. Reference was made to the Gephardt case. I don't see anywhere in that case that says notice has to be given to the Mitchell Area Charitable Foundation or anyone in a similar situation. Gephardt does say and provide that the Attorney General of South Dakota is the proper party to represent the interests of unnamed charitable beneficiaries. He appeared in this case. He's represented the potential beneficiaries, and he even participated in the trial. So apparently he thought that the briefs filed by counsel and myself covered all aspects of this case, and he saw no need to participate further. I've read the reply brief of counsel, and I'm having a difficult time understanding it. I think what they're saying is the Don Museum had a right to try the case, but now they have no right to appeal. I can't follow that logic, because if they're successful in the appeal, then they will have the control of where those funds go. So obviously they have an interest in this case and have the right to this appeal. As distinguished between the Dow Museum, which participated in the trial court and took action, filed briefs, called witnesses, the foundation has not done anything. They've not participated. They've not shown any interest in the case. The Dow Museum and the United Federation of Dow Clubs
have. No matter how you slice it, the Chump Foundation is not a party nor an adverse party to this action. Core Trust is attempting to stretch Crouch, considering its failure to serve a named party, with Ferg and Lucy Ziegler also considering the failure to serve a named party, and Morrell again failing to serve a named party named Mr. Levi, to include having to serve an unnamed party. It just doesn't...
Do you agree, though, you mentioned just before, you're relying on cases that Morrell specifically overruled. Are you saying now that we have to overrule Morrell?
I'm saying, Your Honor, that Morrell, I think, was an error in that they failed to account for the fact that every one of the cases they cited, they were named parties that were not served with notice of appeal, and they overlooked that fact. I maintain that the Mitchell Area Charitable Foundation is not an adverse party nor even a party whose liability will be affected. It does not have a vested interest. Therefore, it is not a vested beneficiary of the trust. Therefore, it does not fall under the nature of provisions of SECL 21-22 and is not entitled to notice of appeal. Failure to give notice of appeal is fatal. Not fatal. Some 50 years later, I sadly state that I didn't find it necessary to write Long Song on top of my notes. Thank you.
Well, we hope you enjoyed yourself more this time.
You know, well, thank you. I did.
Good. Glad to hear it. Okay. Ms. Morgan, you have 10 minutes.
Thank you. First of all, the Morrell case definitely went into some detail and discussion of its opinion, and it stated that insofar as the summary of the previous decisions cited by Mr. Paternas are concerned, they are expressly overruled, and it stated that it is apparent that this court in the above cases overlooked the fact that a right could arise from the judgment that did not exist before, a right which cannot be denied to a party to the judgment without notice, regardless of his failure to appear in the action or suit. And so the very thing that Mr. Paternas is arguing that this court overlooked, they state that the previous cases he's referring to overlooked, and they overlooked the fact that a person, whether they are a named party or not, can have a vested right after the underlying court action to which they are entitled to notice of an appeal. And so it is exactly the opposite of what was happening in that particular case. And the trust cases are a little bit different than normal civil actions in the sense that you don't have always a plaintiff and a defendant. You have a trust with a trustee and named beneficiaries and contingent beneficiaries whose rights may or may not come about depending upon whether they're waiting for an event to occur like the death of a person, that sort of thing. But all of those persons under the statute, under South Dakota Codified Law 21-22-1, are parties with an interest who are entitled to notice of the proceedings. The reconciliation that we make in our reply brief is with regard to the trust restatement and Bogart's on trust, wherein they identify parties who have an interest in participating in the underlying action in the Cypre matter. And it can be very broad. It can be the public at large. However, upon the court's determination of who the beneficiary is, that is an order that determines the beneficiary in a Cypre action because the court modifies the trust and names the beneficiary. And at that point, it's very different who has a right to enforce the trust or to appeal it. And some states declare that it is exclusively the Attorney General's office. If that is the finding of this court, if the court adopts that rule, then neither of the parties, the Doll Museum or the Doll Club, would be entitled to an appeal in this case. Even if that's not the finding of the court, the general rule is that the party has to have a special interest of some nature. The Kansas City Doll Museum would never have a special interest because they were not named in the document and they are an unsuccessful party. The Doll Museum could have a right to appeal if, in fact, they were contesting in the underlying case that they still exist. They should still get the funds, and the court determined adversely to them that they could not. In that case, they would have a special interest because upon reversal, they would receive the funds.
Wouldn't they have a special interest to see where they go, even if they're not trying to get back up and running?
One would think that if they were actually the set lore, that they may, but in this case, they were not. They were strictly a beneficiary, so we're arguing at this point that that's not the case.
Okay.
So in this case, they would not receive the funds, and the Kansas City Doll Museum was merely an interested party in the underlying action, permissibly participating, but at the point where the court determined that they were unsuccessful and that the Mitchell-Erie Charitable Foundation should receive the funds, they no longer had any rights to the corpus of the trust and no enforcement rights. At that point, Mitchell-Erie Charitable Foundation received rights to the corpus of the trust, potentially enforcement rights. The trustee would have enforcement rights, and the Attorney General's office would have enforcement rights.
Would the Attorney General's office then be representing the unsuccessful beneficiaries as well?
The Attorney General's office could, yes. And there are cases where the Attorney General's office has taken the position that the underlying court proceedings were an error and that the party who should have received them is the unsuccessful claimant, so that, yes, they could.
So what happens in a case like here where he looks it over and says, well, I think everybody's got an attorney and it's well being well handled, so I'm not going to get involved? It's a catch-22 for these folks. They've got to have the AG represent them, but he says, no, thank you, you already got a good attorney.
We would acknowledge that that would be the case. I don't believe that that was the position of the Attorney General in this case. I believe the Attorney General's duty is to protect the public interests, the public charitable interests, and to, in a sense, protect the settlor's intent. And so if the Attorney General's office chose to, they could intervene based on those reasons, or not intervene, but participate based upon those reasons. In this case, that they felt that the public's interests were protected by the decision of the court. And forgive me because I don't recall the direct language, but my understanding was they felt that any decision the court made with the options available to the court would have protected the public interest. And so I would just strictly refer to their letter or statement. But I think the key is that the property interest that is established by a court order is what causes the person to have a right to notice of an appeal. If the court follows the general rule, what occurs in most of those cases is that an unsuccessful party then, because they don't have the vested right, they participate by amicus curiae brief to the court and not a direct participant in the action.
But under that logic, they could, if they're amicus, they could never bring the appeal.
Correct. And that is the generally accepted rule. The other argument that I will briefly address is the argument of the liability not having changed. The issue really isn't whether the party appealing has necessarily a liability. The issue also includes whether they have a property interest to be protected. So Mr. Paternas was indicating that if a party argues that they have a notice to appeal, they must establish that if the court were to reverse the case, that they would have some liability, in which case the Mitchell-Erie Charitable Foundation wouldn't have any liability. We are asserting that it also has to do with the fact that if a party has a property right that could be affected by a reversal upon appeal, they should be entitled to receive notice. And that is the conclusion of my rebuttal.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Morgan. The court will be in recess until 10 o'clock.